was when she told me about the notices.
Chapter 62.
The three of us sat side by side, leaning against the stone wall. I imagined they stared into the black void, just as I did. I was grateful that I couldn't see Pauline's face as she recounted the betrayal. Her voice was still filled with disbelief and wobbled in a soft, dangerous way between misery and cold rage. Just when I thought she would break, a terrible quietness roared up in her, one that was feral and sharp and thirsty for revenge. Gwyneth told me that before they were taken, she had heard Pauline call her from the cottage porch. She had looked out the window, and when she saw the soldiers coming, she wrapped the baby in a blanket and laid him beneath the bed, where he wouldn't be seen. Pauline's voice turned thin and fearful again.
"Caden will find him. Don't you think, Leah?"
Gwyneth had already reassured her that Caden would hear him crying when he returned from the mill. I'd started to add my own affirmation when Pauline reached out for my hand and felt the bloody mess of it. I groaned at her touch.
"Dear gods, what happened?"
We had embraced when they were thrown into the room, but in the darkness she hadn't seen my hand. I had already explained my encounter with my father, the Chancellor, and the guards who dragged me here, but now I told them about my unfortunate encounter with Malik and the bolt. Pauline was horrified and immediately began tearing a strip from the bottom of her skirt for a bandage. Gwyneth stood and felt her way through the corners of the room, and when she had found a handful of cobwebs, she stumbled back toward me and wrapped them around my hand. Though the court physician would have disapproved highly of such kitchen remedies, it helped slow the steady ooze from my hand.
"Was it hard?" Pauline asked. "To kill him?"
"No," I answered. It had been easy. Did that make me little more than an animal? That was what I felt like now, a knot of teeth and claws ready to kill anything that walked through the door.
How I wish I'd had a bolt in my hand when Mikhail came and pointed us out.
Pauline mimicked his voice as she recounted his words again.
"It was my duty to turn you in," he said. "I'm a soldier, and you're a wanted criminal of the kingdom. I had no other choice."
She tied off the bandage.
"Duty! When I saw the magistrate toss him a bag of coin, Mikhail shrugged, like he hadn't known about the bounty."
"How did he know you'd be at the caretaker's cottage?" I asked.
"I'm afraid he knows me far better than I know him. I'm guessing he was the one who followed me to the inn and alerted the Chancellor. When he didn't find me there, he thought of another place I might go. The cottage was where we used to..."
She sighed and didn't finish her thought. She didn't need to. "And I was just the lucky bonus in the whole bargain," Gwyneth said cheerfully. "Wait until the Chancellor finds out I'm involved. That should be ugly. I learned a long time ago how delightfully vicious he can be." And then, for the first time, she opened up about Simone. "Maybe when you're about to die, secrets don't seem so important to keep." She sighed with an air of disgust that I think was directed at herself. "I was 19 when I met him. He was older, powerful, and showered me with attention. I found him charming, if you can believe that. But the truth is, even then, I knew he was dangerous on some level. I thought it was exciting compared to my dreary life as a chambermaid in Graceport. He wore expensive clothes and spoke so properly, and it made me feel like I was somehow just as important as he was. I passed information on to him for almost a year. Because of the port, a lot of lords and wealthy merchants frequented the inn. It wasn't until two patrons I had given him information about turned up dead in their beds that I grasped how dangerous he was. He told me they had become a liability. Everything that I had thought was exciting about him suddenly became terrifying." She said by that point she was already pregnant. She made up a story for him that she'd found a job elsewhere and would have said or done anything to get the baby away from him. He didn't try to stop her from leaving. He wasn't happy about the child, and she was still afraid he might do something to her or the baby. She kept Simone for only a few months. She had run out of funds, had no one to turn to, and was worried the Chancellor might track her down. Passing through Terravin, she spotted an older couple who doted on some children in the square. She learned they were childless, and followed them to a home that was neat and tidy. They even had red geraniums in pots on their windowsill. I held Simone in my arms for 2 hours, staring at those flowers. I knew they'd make good parents. She paused, and I heard a swiping sound, like she was brushing tears from her cheeks. After I left her there, I didn't come back to Terravin for over 2 years. I was still afraid someone would make the connection. But not a day went by that I didn't think about her. They're good people. We don't ever talk about it. I guess they know I don't want to. But they know who I am, and they make room in their lives for me. She's a happy and sweet little girl. Nothing like me, thank the gods. Or him. Her voice cracked as if she knew she might never see her daughter again. Hearing the steely Gwyneth break squeezed the air from my chest. Stop, I said. We'll get out of this. Damn right we will, Pauline growled. Gwyneth and I sucked in startled breaths, then laughed. I pictured Pauline gripping a bolt in her fist with Mikhail's name engraved on it. Gwyneth reached out and held my good hand. I hung my other hand over Pauline's shoulder and pulled her close. We leaned into one another, our arms tangled, forehead to cheek, chin to shoulder, tears and strength binding us. We'll get out of this, I whispered again. And then we shared the silence, knowing what was coming. Gwyneth pulled away first, leaning back against the wall again. What I can't figure out is why we're not all dead already. What are they waiting for? Confirmation, I said. The conclave is back in session, and someone who's a deciding factor in this little conspiracy is otherwise occupied. Maybe the royal scholar. The conclave breaks for midday meal, Pauline said. Then we have until midday, I replied. Or maybe longer if my backup plan worked out. But as every minute passed and I listened for the sound of the abbey bells ringing, I became more certain that plan had been thwarted too. My anger spiked. I should have stabbed the Komazar again, carved him up like a holiday goose, then brought his head back skewered on a sword and showed it to the crowds as proof that I had no love for the tyrant. Why did they believe the lies? I asked. How could a whole kingdom believe I would marry the Komazar and betray a company of soldiers, including my own brother? Gwyneth sighed. They were cut to the quick, she said, grieving and desperate. 33 of their finest young men were dead, and the Chancellor stepped forward and provided them with an easy outlet for their rage. A face and name they knew that had already turned her back on them once. It was easy for them to believe. But if I hadn't run away, I never would have found out about the Komazar's plans, or the traitors. I'd be blissfully living in another kingdom with Rafe, at least until the Komazar turned his attention toward Dalbrek. And the young Vendans who were barely big enough to lift a sword would get the worst of it all— sacrificial lambs the Komazar would place on the front lines, probably to storm the gates of the city. He would use the children to prick the consciences of Moragi's soldiers. Neither my brothers nor their comrades would ever strike down a child. They would hold their weapons, hesitate, and then the Komazar would move in with his arsenal of destruction. Pauline gently laid her hand on my thigh. But not everyone believed the lies. Bryn and Regan didn't believe a word of it. Maybe that was why they were on their way to their deaths now. They had asked too many questions. We sat there in the dark, each of us lost to our own thoughts, my hand throbbing in time with my heart, the strange tingle of the cobwebs against my skin running up my arm like a thousand tiny spiders. A kitchen remedy. Something the court physician would never use. Not on his own. The blackness swirled in front of me, and the thousand tiny spiders became a field of golden flowers. A face rose out of them, calm and sure. He never asked me about the gift, because he knew I had it. It was what had made him afraid of me all along. She will expose the wicked. And I saw a wide continent of kingdoms, each with their own unique gifts, the face receding, and fields of flowers rippling in the breeze until they became spiders again, resting in my palm. The door opened, and we were blinded by the sudden light. I heard the Chancellor's haughty sigh before I saw him. "Gwyneth," he said, drawing her name out in exaggerated disappointment. "I thought you were smarter than this." He clucked his tongue. "Conspiring with enemies." Gwyneth shot him a withering stare, and he returned it with a smile. Then his eyes met mine. I got to my feet and limped toward him. He resisted stepping back, not wanting to show any fear. I was, after all, injured, weaponless, and a prisoner. But I saw a brief flicker in his eyes, a heartbeat of doubt. It confirmed he'd read the Song of Venda. She will expose the wicked. What if I did? He eyed my bloodied, bandaged hand. His arrogant sneer returned. I didn't look so mighty now. I was only the nuisance that had forever plagued him, one with a name he couldn't quite explain. But I was not a threat. The small doubt that ate at him vanished. "Don't do this, Lord Chancellor," I said. "Don't kill my brothers." A satisfied puff of air escaped his lips.
"So that's what did it. What made you finally run to your father?"
"If my father dies..."
"You mean when your father dies. But I wouldn't worry. It won't come as soon as your own death. We need him a little longer.
If you surrender now, I will spare your life." The back of his hand swung, his jeweled fingers meeting my jaw, and I stumbled into the wall. Gwyneth and Pauline jumped forward.
"Stay back," I ordered.
"You spare my life," he sneered. "You're insane."
I turned to face him again and smiled. "No, Chancellor. I only wanted to give you a chance. Now my obligation to the gods is done." I briefly fluttered my lashes, as if the gods were speaking to me. The doubt trailed through his eyes again, like a stalking animal he couldn't quite shake.
"Take off your jacket," he ordered.
I stared at him, wondering about his motive.
"Do it now," he growled, "or I'll have them do it for you."
I pulled it off, letting it fall to the ground. He nodded to the guards, and they grabbed my arms and turned my back toward him. One of them yanked at my shirt, ripping the fabric from my shoulder. The silence stretched, marked only by his slow, restrained breaths. I could feel his hatred burning into me. The guards let go, pushing me forward, and the Chancellor said,
"Kill them. Once it's dark, take the bodies far outside the city and burn them. Make sure no trace of that thing on her shoulder is left."
As he turned to leave, the guards moved toward us, drawing thin silk ropes taut between their hands, a silent, bloodless way to dispose of us. But then there was a sound, the distant ringing of bells.
Listen, Chancellor, I said quickly, before he could leave. Do you hear that?
The Abbey bells, he snapped with irritation. So what?
I smiled. It's an announcement. An important one, from your office, no less. You didn't happen to notice your seal was missing? The last of the bills are being posted. Citizens from all over the city are reading them as we speak. Princess Arabella has been captured. All citizens are invited to the trial and hanging tomorrow morning in the village plaza. It would be a shame indeed if you didn't produce her. Embarrassing, even. How would you ever explain your incompetence?
I watched a splotchy red patch on his neck spread to his cheeks and temples, like flames in a wildfire, out of control and consuming.
Wait,
he said to the guards, and ordered them out. The door slammed shut behind all of them, and I heard him yelling for the bills to be ripped down. But it was too late. He knew it was too late.
Well done, sister, Gwyneth said. But tomorrow morning? You couldn't have put the trial off a week?
And give them more time to find a way to dispose of us quietly?
No. We'll be lucky if we last until morning. They would never give me a chance to speak at trial. All this does is buy us a few more hours, but at least now they will be frantic, and perhaps making stupid mistakes.
I felt my way along the wall until my foot nudged Gwyneth's leg. Get up, I said. Both of you. In the meantime, I need to show you some moves I learned from a Dalbrecht soldier. Ways to kill a man without using a weapon for when the guards come back.
Chapter 63
Footsteps tramped down the stone passageway only an hour later. I'd thought we'd have more time. They were loud and hurried, angry. We all stood, braced against the opposite wall, waiting for the door to open, dirt gathered into our fists, ready to fling into their eyes. When the door opens, give your eyes a chance to adjust to the light, I said. We only get one chance at this. Make your aim count. Pauline whispered prayers while Gwyneth uttered curses. They had ripped several strips from Gwyneth's dress and woven them into a tight, thin rope, knotting the ends so they would each have a good grip on it. The guards wouldn't be the only one with garrots. My left hand could do little, but I could still do plenty of damage to a windpipe with the knuckles of my right hand. I had told Gwyneth and Pauline the weak points I had noted on the guards. Besides their eyes, their groins, noses, and knees were all vulnerable. And their throats. They wore only weapons, no armor. At some point in our planned melee, I hoped to secure the weapon of at least one of the disabled guards. The footsteps stopped outside the door. Keys rattled. The lock rattled. Muffled curses. More rattling. Hurry! My grip tightened on the dirt in my hand. Hurry! Something about it didn't sound right. An angry jangle of keys.
Damn it! Stand back!
A crash shook the door, and another. The crack of splintering wood juddered off the walls. A hole breached the door, then a ray of light, and the silver tip of an axe. The axe tip disappeared momentarily, and there was another loud crack as it broke through again. The door swung open, and I was ready to lunge, but then... bright eyes and a grin. Black ropes of hair. Sights I didn't expect to see. Wait! I shouted, putting my hand out to stop the others. Caden stood on the other side of the splintered door, the axe still gripped in his hand. Sweat glistened on his brow, and his chest heaved with exertion. Jeb and Tavish stepped past him, and I told Gwyneth and Pauline they could be trusted. Jeb extended his hand.
Thank the gods that we found you. This way, he said. We don't have much time.
I dropped my fistful of dirt, thinking how close I'd come to crushing his windpipe. Jeb smiled.
You remembered.
Did you doubt me?
Never.
Pauline ran toward Caden, slamming her hands against his shoulders.
The baby!
He's fine, Caden answered. Bertie has him and fetched a wet nurse. I told her to go to the Abbey to hide.
Hurry,
This way, Tavish ordered.
He turned and led us down a passageway. I recognized where we were now, the Citadel Armory, one of the outbuildings. It was small compared to the armory at Pierre's camp, meant only to arm the Citadel guards. They must have been holding us in one of its storage rooms, but this only confirmed my suspicions. While the Citadel guards might be complicit in the traitor's schemes, it didn't mean soldiers in the ranks were. I heard a battery of shouts ahead. Jeb, who brought up the rear, noticed my slowing steps and said,
"Don't worry, they're ours."
Ours? I tried to make sense of it as I ran. We poured through a door that emptied into the main supply room, and in the center of it were five men, partially dressed in various stages of pulling on uniforms. A half dozen more lay face down, their hands shackled behind them, the tips of swords held to their necks by just as many plain-cloaked men. Sven ripped shirts into strips and called Jeb and Tavish to help him gag the shackled men.
"Are you all right?"
Kaden asked, taking another look at me and reaching for my hand. "I'm fine," I said, pulling away. "The watch captain is in on it. And at least some of the Citadel guards are Venden, too. They speak flawless Morrigese. It seems the scholars were busy tutoring in languages, too." Anger flashed in Caden's eyes. There was so much the Komazar had never told him. But that was the Komazar's way, using many people like puppets, but never sharing too much information with a single one. The power had to remain all his. Caden grabbed a strip of cloth.
"Let's wrap it a little more," he said,
lifting my bloody bandaged hand. He saw me blanch with pain.
"How bad is it?"
"I live," I said. "Malik, not so much. He's dead. The Komazar and his writhing nest of cavern worms have developed another interesting weapon, a crossbow that shoots multiple iron bolts at a time. Luckily, only one of them got me." He gently wrapped the strip of fabric around my hand.
"Hold your breath," he said, before pulling the fabric tight. "A little pressure will help stop the bleeding."
The pain jolted through me and then pulsed up my arm.
"I'll get you a cloak," he said. "You can't walk out of here looking like that without drawing attention. And then there's more I need to tell you."
He went over to a jumbled pile on a table, the discarded clothes of the half-dressed men, I presumed, and sorted through them. Father McGuire came up behind me, startling me with his attire. A sword was belted at his side, almost hidden by his robes.
"You know how to use one of those?" I asked.
"I'm about to learn," he answered, and then he told me he had finally found the information in the archives that I had asked for.
"There were no relatives."
I nodded. This was only further confirmation. Another piece of the blurred picture that had come into focus in the darkness of the cell. Gwyneth and Pauline had already stepped into the middle of the room, taking in the bustle of activity and becoming part of it, a plan in the making that I was beginning to grasp. At the far corner of the room, I spotted Orin pulling halberds from a rack, and then Natia carrying an armful of baldricks, all tooled with the Morrigese insignia. She handed them to the half-dressed soldiers and crossed the room to Gwyneth and Pauline, a chatter of noise and explanations I only half heard because in the opposite corner, something else caught my eye. A warrior. Someone swinging a flanged mace to break the lock on another weapon cabinet. The lock flew into a wall, and the cabinet banged open. But then he stopped, seeming to sense me at the same time. He turned, his eyes finding mine, and then his attention dropped to my bandaged hand. Looking down, I saw that my trousers and shirt were covered in blood. He crossed the room, his steps measured. Calculation. For all his zeal in shattering the lock, there was restraint in his movements as he approached me. The stiffness of his stride, the pull of his shoulders. Holding back. That's what I saw in his movement, but not what I saw in his gaze when he stopped in front of me.
In his eyes, I saw him drawing me into his arms, his lips lowering to mine, a kiss that would never end, holding me until the kingdoms vanished and the world stood still, being everything we had ever been to each other. Before. I waited, expected, wanted. Some things last. The things that matter. And yet he held back. Distant. A king. A soldier calculating his next move.
There isn't time to explain, he said.
I don't need an explanation. You're here. That's all that matters. He glanced at my hand.
We can wait and regroup, or move forward now. It's your decision.
I surveyed his soldiers in the room. How many do you have?
100, but they're...
I know, I said. They're the best. There were only hours left before the last session of the conclave ended and the lords dispersed back to their homes. Now was my last chance to speak to them all. Minutes counted.
My brothers are headed into an ambush. My father's dying, and the Komazar is on his way. There's no more time to wait.
The Komazar? The bridge is fixed?
I nodded. He lifted my chin, turning my face toward the window.
You're pale. How much of this blood is yours?
Most of it. But I heard a perilous edge to his voice and decided against the truth.
Most is Malik's. He got the worst of it. He's dead.
Then you're able to carry a weapon?
Yes, I said, sheathing a sword Caden handed me, feeling like my movements had already become their movements. The others had finished their preparations and gathered behind Rafe, waiting for my answer, too. 6 of Rafe's men, including Jeb, were now outfitted as Citadel guards. The rest of them wore the plain, rough-spun cloaks favored by the local farmers and merchants, all in different shades and styles so as not to draw attention. Tavish and Orin wore similar garb, as did Sven. Pauline and Gwyneth were belted with weapons and had donned cloaks, too.
This was it, I thought,
and terror rose in my throat.
She stays, I said, pointing to Natia.
She flew forward, enraged. Caden grabbed her from behind, pinning her to his chest.
Listen to her, Natia, he said.
Listen.
Don't make her look over her shoulder with worry for you. She will. We all have our weaknesses, and you will be hers. Please. Your day will come.
Her eyes puddled with tears, and her gaze locked on mine.
Today is my day.
Her voice wobbled with anger.
She understood little of the workings of the court, nor who had betrayed whom. She knew only that she wanted justice. But even today could not give her back what she had lost.
No, I said, not today. I see many tomorrows for you, Natia, days I will need you at my side, but this is not one of them. Please go back to the Abbey and wait with Birdie. Her lip trembled. She was 13 years old and ready to fight the world, but she saw I wouldn't be moved and angrily turned away. Leaving for the Abbey. I looked back at Rafe. He nodded.
Let's go get some traitors.
We circled behind the outbuilding, walking through the village, Rafe on one side of me, Caden on the other. A wagon trudged alongside us, a wheelbarrow pushed a little farther ahead, and still more followed behind with burlap sacks slung over shoulders, their supposed wares spilling over the top. Our boots tapped an uneven beat on the cobblestones. The wagon wheels creaked and bumped. Our cloaks flapped in the wind, every noise sounding like a herald announcing our approach, and yet somehow we blended in with citizens going about their business. As we walked, more fell into step with us, waiting and ready, looking like merchants headed for the marketplace. And I wondered how Rafe had been able to assemble such a squad, not just soldiers, but performers as well, perceiving the smallest of cues. He had said they numbered 100 strong. I thought about what the 6 of us had been able to do in Venda.
But then we had been running away from the enemy, not trying to settle into their dark den. How long could 100 soldiers hold off the Morrigese army? There were at least 2,000 troops stationed at Pierre's camp, only a short distance away. My heart pounded. This was no childhood rebellion. This was a coup, and in the eyes of Morrigese law, the most unforgivable crime. I had received an extensive lecture on it when I was 14. Back then, my punishment had been banishment to my chamber for a month. Today, if we failed, the rebellion would be grounds for a mass hanging of epic proportions. I tried not to think of the shortcomings of our small army. Only what was at stake? Everything. The front of the citadel was in sight, and for the first time, Rafe's steps faltered. I can't promise that Morrigese soldiers won't die. I nodded. I had told Rafe and his men that I wanted as little blood spilled as possible. While there were Vendans among the citadel guards, some of them were still Morrigese, and surely believed they were only following orders. He still didn't move forward, a scowl pulling between his brows. You don't have to go in, Leah. We can go first, and once the hall is secure, we can send for you. He and Caden exchanged a glance. A knowing glance. If either of you try to stop me, you will die. Do you understand? You're injured, Leah, Caden said. One hand is injured, I answered. My strengths are not your strengths. We reached the plaza, and the men disguised as citadel guards walked up the steps to the string of guards stationed at the entrance. Jeb, his Morrigese pitch perfect, told them his squad was there to relieve them. The center guard looked confused, not recognizing Jeb or the others, and balked. But it was too late for them to act. Rafe's men were quick and assured, and their short swords cut the air with a single united shing, just as quickly pressing them to the guards' chests. They pushed them back into the dark recess of the portal, taking their weapons while the rest of us flooded up the steps, shedding cloaks and unfurling more weapons from wagons and sacks. Taking the next line of guards wasn't as bloodless. They spotted us from the end of the passageway. Two of them moved to close the heavy hallway doors, while the rest charged shoulder to shoulder toward us, bearing halberds that far outreached our swords. Rafe's archers stepped forward, shouting a warning order to stop. They didn't, and multiple arrows flew beneath the guards' shields and into their legs. When they stumbled, they were overtaken, and we charged the doors before the other guards were able to bar it. As one of them began to shout a warning, Sven knocked him unconscious. The last two guards, posted outside the closed doors to Aldred Hall, were ceremonial at best. Their purpose was to turn away uninvited visitors, not defend against attackers. Their hair was silver, their stomachs paunchy, and their armor consisted only of a leather helmet and breastplate. They drew their swords uncertainly. I stepped forward, and they recognized me.
Your Highness!
The guard caught himself, unsure what to call me.
Lay down your weapons and step aside, I ordered. We don't want to hurt you, but we will. The kingdom and my brothers' lives are at stake.
Their eyes bulged with fear, but they stood their ground.
We have our orders.
As do I answered. Move. Now. Every second you delay puts lives at risk.
They didn't budge. I looked at the archers who stood to my right.
Shoot them, I commanded.
When the guards shifted their attention to the archers, Rafe and Caden moved in from the left, striking the swords from their grasps and slamming both men against the wall. Before the doors were opened, we implemented the last of our plans. Other than myself, only Pauline knew the layout of the citadel, and I sent her off with precise instructions about what she was to bring back to me. Jeb and Captain Azia went with her. The guard posted at the door is Vendan, I said. You may have to kill him. Caden left with two of the soldiers dressed as citadel guards. His quest was more uncertain, though though I told him exactly what to look for. Gwyneth was sent in yet another direction with the rest of the soldiers dressed as guards. With the whole cabinet convened in Aldred Hall, I prayed the passageways would be mostly empty. My head pounded with the sound of their receding footsteps, a lifetime of voices awakening within me.
"Hold your tongue, Arabella. Quiet. This matter is finished. Go to your chamber."
Rafe and Tavish looked at me, waiting for the signal that I was ready. Other voices sounded in my head.
"Don't tarry, miss. Trust the strength within you. Nurse the rage. Use it." That was easy to do. I drew my sword and nodded. The doors were opened, and I went in with Rafe on one side, Tavish on the other, Orin and his best archers flanking us, Sven leading the lines of shield-bearers before us, and more soldiers pulling up the rear. Soldiers willing to lay their lives down for another kingdom and an uncertain cause.
Chapter 64, Rafe.
Up until this point, everything had been planned with precision. From here forward, Sven said it was another half-assed plan, but he also noted that he was becoming more comfortable with military strategies that were half-assed. Tavish had snorted at the word strategy. As we stormed the hall, we had skill and surprise on our side, and little else. What the next minutes and hours would bring were uncertain, but I knew we were running out of time. I knew it the minute Leah had walked into the armory. There was already a war going on, the traitors against Leah, and right now it looked like the traitors were winning. Tavish muttered under his breath as we rushed in, eyeing the long upper gallery and balcony that overlooked the hall. Leah had said it was accessible only from the royal wing, but if archers flooded it before we could secure it, we would be like fish in a barrel, waiting to be speared one at a time. We guarded Leah's back and one another's. Lords and ministers gasped, too startled to grasp what was happening as my men filled out the perimeter. Guards posted at the dais stayed their hands when our archers targeted them in their sights. Tavish and I kept close to Leah, our shields raised, watching, turning, scanning the room. Orin flanked us with his men, their arrows already aimed at the two towers, ready to return attacks. Leah stopped in the center of the room and yelled that no one should move, promising they wouldn't be hurt. She lied. There would be blood spilled. I saw it in her eyes, her face, her lips, the hungry rage. I thought it might be all that kept her standing. Her eyes were circled with shadows, her lips pale. I knew she had lied to me back at the armory. She'd lost a lot of blood. But I also understood the rush of battle and the surge of strength that kept dead men on their feet. Along with her desperate fury, it kept her going now. I ordered the doors barred and the guards relieved of their weapons. A lord, who had been addressing the cabinet, remained frozen in the large, semicircular step at the front of the hall, unable to speak or move. I motioned to him with my sword. "Sit down." He scrambled back to his seat, and Leah walked up the steps, taking his place. Her scrutiny passed over the cabinet, and she addressed each one, nodding her head as if in greeting, but I saw the fear in their eyes. They knew it was no greeting. Every one of them saw the thin line she walked and the multiple weapons strapped to her side. The Chancellor jumped to his feet. "This is preposterous!" An echo of agreement rumbled around him, chairs scraping back as if to escort the insolent princess to her chamber. Before I could say anything, Leah threw her dagger. "I told you not to move," she yelled. The blade nicked the Chancellor's sleeve and lodged in a carved wooden wall behind him. A hush returned to the hall. The Chancellor held his arm, blood seeping between his fingers. His head shook with rage, but he returned to his seat. That's better, she said. I don't want you dead yet, Lord Chancellor. You'll hear me out first. He may have sat, but he wasn't silenced. So you throw knives to muzzle the captain and have a ragtag collection of sword-wielding rebels whom you've compelled to follow you, he said. What are you going to do? Hold off the entire Morrigese army? I stepped forward. As a matter of fact, yes, we are. The Chancellor skimmed the length of me, taking in my rough-spun clothes. His lip lifted in disgust. And you would be? For someone in his precarious position, he showed no signs of backing down. His arrogance made mine blaze. I would be the King of Dalbrick, I answered. And I can assure you my ragtag collection can hold off your army for an amazingly extended period of time, at least long enough to see you dead. The watch captain snickered. Fool! We've met the King of Dalbrick, and you are not him! I closed the space between us and reached across the table, grabbing him by the front of his tunic. I jerked him to his feet. Are you willing to bet your life on that, Captain? Because even though you've never seen me, I saw you from the cloister of the Abbey on the day of my thwarted wedding. You nervously paced with the timekeeper, cursing as I recall. I let go of his tunic, shoving him back in his seat. My father has passed. I'm king now, and I've yet to behead anyone in my new capacity, though I'm eager to see what it's like. I stared, pinning him to his seat, then looked at the rest of the cabinet, scanning as Leah had done, wondering which hand had struck her, which had torn the shirt from her back, and worse, which of her own had betrayed her and every other kingdom on the continent by conspiring with the Komazar, trading our lives for their greed. Other than the Chancellor and the Watch Captain, the rest had remained curiously silent, and I found their quiet brooding just as disturbing as the outbursts. They plotted. I looked at Leah. Speak, Princess. You have the floor as long as you like. She smiled, a frightening hardness to her lips. The floor, she repeated, savoring the words as she turned, her arms held out to her sides. Forgive me, esteemed ministers, for the state of my— She looked down at her blood-stained clothes, then at her exposed shoulder. My appearance. I know it doesn't follow court protocol, but there's some comfort in it, too, I suppose. Beaten and scorned, she will expose the wicked. She paused, the smile slipping from her face. Do those words frighten you? They should. She turned, her gaze traveling over the lords, then she stopped and looked up at the empty gallery. Every eye followed her stare. The silence grew long and uncomfortable. But for now, the memory of her knife flying across the room seemed to keep their tongues quiet. My pulse raced, and Tavish and I exchanged a worried glance. She seemed to have forgotten where we were or what she was doing. I followed her gaze. There was nothing there. Nothing, at least, that I could see.
Chapter 65.
The air changed, hanging above us, the color soft and muted, like aged parchment. The room grew larger, dreamlike, becoming a distant world where a 14-year-old girl charged with her brothers by her side. More who believed in her followed close behind. They were all dead now, killed on a nameless battlefield. Walther whispered, "Be careful, sister." I heard the girl yell that no one should move, and she promised they wouldn't be hurt. She knew that wasn't true. Some would die, though she didn't know which ones or when, but their deaths already clouded behind her eyes. She saw two men charging with her, watching, turning, archers flanking her with arrows drawn. And then her eyes landed on the cabinet, the faces, the empty seat of her father. The air snapped sharp, the colors brilliant, and fear vibrated against the walls in waves. The girl was gone. It was only me, facing them. And today, no one would be banishing me to my chamber. The vice-regent, the chancellor, the watch captain, the trade master, the court physician, the timekeeper, the field marshal, the hunt master, and of course, the royal scholar, who looked the most troubled of all by the turn of events. Notably absent was the first daughter and the king himself, but one of them would be here soon. The timekeeper fiddled nervously with the buttons on his jacket, pulling and fretting until one popped off. It clattered to the floor, rolling across the polished stone. I knew who the mastermind behind this was, the architect who craved power just as much as the Komizar. Maybe even more, risking everything for the whole prize, the continent. I looked at him, slow and steady. It was obvious now. The scales of his true nature gleamed beneath his robe. The dragon who had as many faces as the Komizar. When the Chancellor disobeyed the first of my orders, my dagger flew. It took all of my will not to aim straight for his heart. In my days crossing the Camlan Toe, every time I practiced throwing my knife into the trunk of a tree, I had marked his heart as the target in my mind's eye. But his death would come later. For now he might still be of some use to me, and I would use every piece of him, finger by finger, if that was what it took to save my brothers. He sat, but seethed, now throwing insults at Rafe. I watched him and the others, one by one, down the line, for a conspiracy was only as good as its weakest link. And now that link was being tested. The citadel closed in, contracting, squeezing the treachery into something hard and alive, its heartbeat wild, resisting, its beastly roar echoing. But beneath it all I heard another sound, a fragile thrum as persistent as hope. And I saw someone step out on the balcony. It was a girl. She leaned over the rail, her wide dark eyes fixed on mine. "Promise," she said. I nodded. I promised long ago. And then she was gone, the world shifting, the air sharp and bright again. The lords waited, their attention whittled to a point, ready to snap. I told them of traitors in their midst, of dragons with unquenchable thirst, and still another, the Komizar of Venda, who was on his way here with an unstoppable army to destroy them all, helped by the same traitors who had sent Crown Prince Walther to his death. I ran from the wedding because I was afraid, but I did not betray Morrigan, and I did not betray my brother. I watched him die, but at the hands of Vendans who were lying in wait for him. He was sent into an ambush by traitors here in this room. The same ones who have sent Princes Regan and Bryn to die. The royal scholar leaned forward. Wouldn't this be better discussed in... But the vice-regent cut him off, holding up his hand. Let's not interrupt the princess. Let her have her say. We can give her that much. He eyed me as if recalling every word we had spoken in his office. Do you have any evidence? He knew my word wasn't enough. I glared, slow and steady, at the royal scholar, a warning, your time will come, and turned to the field marshal, who was the cabinet liaison to the troops. My brothers need to be tracked down and brought home immediately. With my father ill, they should never have been sent away to Gitos and Courtenay in the first place. How do you explain this flagrant breach of protocol, Lord Commander? He shifted uncomfortably in his seat and shot a hard glance at the watch captain. The royal scholar watched them all as if ready to jump from his seat.
I didn't want to send them, he answered, a scowl darkening his face. In fact, I argued against it, but I was swayed to believe it was for the good of the realm. And your brothers heartily agreed, the watch captain added. I stormed across the dais, slamming my sword onto the table inches from his hand. They agreed to be slaughtered? The watch captain gawked at his hand as if making sure all his fingers were still there. His gaze shot back to me, his eyes glowing with anger. The girl is insane, he shouted to Rafe's soldiers standing near him. Lay down your weapons before she gets you all killed. The rumble of footsteps echoed in the south hall, the vibration of 100 boots pounding toward us. Soldiers had been alerted. I looked back at the cabinet. The dragon. A smile. One that no one else could see. A voice no one else could hear. More. It is mine. You are mine. The grind of teeth. A gluttonous swallow. A satisfied breath. I turned to Rafe as the rumbling footsteps got louder. He held my gaze and nodded, confident. Keep going. A lord in the back of the hall, apparently emboldened by the sound of soldiers, stood. The only traitor we see in this hall is you. If there were other traitors, you would name them. The watch captain's right. The girl is mad. The vice-regent sighed, tenting his hands in front of him, and frowned. We've allowed you your say, Arabella, but I'm afraid I must agree with Lord Gowan. You can't make these accusations without providing evidence, and we don't see any. I could name many traitors, possibly half of the cabinet, but my only evidence, if Pauline was able to secure it, would be construed as something I had planted. I needed someone else to point the finger. You'll have your evidence, I promised, stalling for time. Where was Pauline? She was coming from the North Hall, but what if her way was already blocked? And you'll get your names. But we haven't discussed... A hand pounded on the north entry door and a shout blared through it. Leah! The bar was lifted, and Pauline rushed across the room, nervously taking in the scrutiny of the cabinet and the lords. She walked up the steps to meet me with a box clutched in her arms. There was another clatter of footsteps, and our men posing as citadel guards rushed to the gallery rail. Gwyneth joined them and nodded to me. More footsteps. Soft. Hurried. A swish of skirts. Aunt Burnett, Aunt Cloris, and Lady Adele, the Queen's attendant, appeared, their hands gripping the rail as their eyes skimmed the room. Their gazes passed over me, and a knot swelled in my throat. I wasn't the same girl who had left here so many months ago, and they didn't recognize me. When they finally realized who I was, Aunt Cloris gasped, and tears flowed down Aunt Burnett's cheeks, but Gwyneth had coached them well. They were not to speak, only bear witness, and they all held their tongues. And then there was a flash of blue, and my lungs squeezed. The Queen stepped forward between my aunts, a shadow of who she had once been. She looked down at me, her eyes dark hollows, her gaze searing into mine. There's nothing to know. It's only the chill of the night. But now we both knew it was far more than a chill. Welcome, Your Majesty, I said. We were just about to discuss the King's health. I turned back to the cabinet. They fidgeted, waiting for me to say something, the watch captain's hands safely tucked beneath the table. The king doesn't seem to be recovering, I said. Can you tell me why?
The news of your betrayal struck him to the core, the chancellor growled. There is no instant cure for a heart ripped from a man's chest.
A few of the lords mumbled agreement. I heard the gentle cries of Aunt Burnett. So I'm told. My eyes landed on the court physician.
Come join me here on the step, I said, so everyone can hear you report on my father's health.
He didn't move,
glancing at the other cabinet members as if they could save him. "It is not a request, Lord Fentley." I held up my bandaged hand. "As you can see, I have a grave injury. Don't make me drag you over here." I sheathed my sword, and he reluctantly stood and walked over. "Arabella," the royal scholar interceded. "Don't!" I turned sharply. "I have no qualms about cutting out your tongue, Your Eminence. In fact, after all the years I had to endure your condemning lectures, it would give me the greatest pleasure. So I would advise that you hold your tongue while you still possess one." Hold it, just like all the times you made me hold mine. His eyes narrowed, familiar, afraid, worried, but not for his tongue, for the truth. My anger burned brighter, and when the physician stopped in front of me, I grabbed his shoulder, forcing him to his knees. "What is wrong with my father?" I asked.
"His heart, Your Highness, as the Chancellor said,"
he answered quickly, his tone high and earnest.
"But his other ailments are many. It is a tricky thing, treating so many conditions. It will take time, but I have the highest hopes for his recovery."
I smiled. "Really? That is reassuring, Lord Fentley." I nodded to Pauline, and she opened the box. "And these are some of the medicines you're treating him with?"
"Yes,"
he said, his tone thick with pleading.
"These are only simple remedies to make him more comfortable."
I reached in and pulled out a small bottle of dark amber elixir. "This?"
"Only to ease aches and pains."
My fingers fumbled, stiff and tingling, to remove the cork with my injured hand. The effort of twisting it free made blood gush warm again beneath the bandage. I sniffed the bottle. "For pain? I could use some of this." I took a hearty swig and shrugged. "There now. I think I'm feeling better already." He smiled, his face a strained smear of anguish and fear. I put the elixir back and drew another bottle, this one filled with creamy white liquid. "And just how does this one help my father?"
"His stomach, Your Highness. It helps settle it."
I held the bottle up, swishing it in the light, then took a drink. I smiled. "Yes, I remember this from my childhood." I leveled a glare at the royal scholar. "I often suffered from stomach aches." I put it back and shuffled through the box, then drew out the small vial filled with golden powder. "And this one?" He swallowed. His skin was pasty, and a bead of sweat trickled near his ear. A half-smile rippled across his lips.
"It is for agitation, just to calm jittery nerves."
"Jittery nerves," I repeated. "Well, I guess you can all see. I certainly have those." I pulled the cork, began to lift it to my mouth, and hesitated. "Does it matter how much I take?" "No," he said, a measure of relief finally reaching his eyes.
"You may take as much as you like."
I lifted it to my lips again. He watched me, his mouth hanging open, waiting for me to take a hefty dose, as I had with the others. I paused and returned his earnest attention. "It seems, Lord Fentley, that you're in need of this far more than I am. Here, take some." I moved it toward his lips, and he quickly turned his head away.
"No, I don't need any."
"But I insist."
"No."
He jerked away, but I drew the knife from my boot and held it to his neck. "See how jittery you are, my lord?" I lowered my voice to a growl. "I insist you take some. Now." My knife pressed harder against his throat, and Lords gasped as a thin line of blood sprang up beneath the blade. I brought the golden vial slowly to his lips. "Remember," I whispered, "you may take as much as you like." The glass brushed his lower lip.
"No,"
he cried, his eyes glazed with terror.
"It's him. He's the one who gave it to me. It was by his order."
He pointed at the vice-regent. I lowered the knife.
pushing the physician free. Silence crushed in as all eyes turned to the favored cabinet member. I smiled at the vice-regent. Thanis, I said. Good for the soul. Good for the heart. A unique token found only in Venda. Something an ambassador